Hey guys, what's up? Welcome to a brand new podcast here at CycloneFanatic.com. Today, I want to welcome our new sponsor, Heartland Flags and Custom Flags. Perfect timing for Heartland Flags and Custom Flags to come on board.
Playoffs are going to start soon in baseball. Yeah. We got footballs kicking up. Everything's
Tailgate season.
Tailgate season. This is Flagville.
It is Flagville. Flagville, USA. It's Cyclone Fanatic. No, I was just telling my wife. Sometimes you say in these promo stuff just to make it sound good. This is 100% God honest truth. I was telling the wife, I really need to get a Vikings flag for, you know, to put outside the
to
house.
Let everybody
on Sunday
in Bondurant know. I'm a Vikings fan.
Well, I got these guys across the street that are Packer fans.
So your flag has to be bigger than theirs.
Yeah.
So whatever theirs, if it's, you know, 2 foot by 3 foot. Yeah. Yours has to be 5 foot by eight foot. You have to get a giant flag, like the Perkins on Euclid. Like, you have to get a flag that big.
Maybe Heartland Custom Flags created the Perkins flag on Euclid. No, but these are really good people, but it's a little sparring match between me and this guy who's the Packer fan. It's kind of like, guys will have competitions over Christmas lights. Mm-hmm. Like, who can put up the most – that's like me and this guy with the Viking Packer hate that's spewing across the street. So I'm gonna be loading up on Vikings. They got a sweet
– you throw a purple brick through his window.
I could do that. And
that's
get arrested.
Win.
I was scouring through their Iowa State flags today, and they have a ton of them. And I feel like Iowa State – I was fairly vocal about this at the time, but I didn't have the platform. You were there. I think. Maybe not. Maybe this is before your time. But I think that they dropped the ball with the I-State logo. It's very identifiable. Like, you look at it, and you know it's Iowa State. But it's just not cool to me.
The leaning sigh.
The walking sigh, I think.
I think the leaning sigh on the eye.
Okay, that's good,
that's
too.
That's my personal favorite sigh, is leaning sigh on the eye. That's personal favorite. Or the tornado chicken.
The tornado chicken. Yeah, that's good, too. I like the walking sigh, like the old school one. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But they have one of those flags where it's like the old school sigh with, like, the helmet on.
Mm-hmm.
See, to me, that would be a badass football helmet.
The other one that I think is the new one that they got, that's like that circle logo that's just got a mean-looking sigh inside of that kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Like, you're looking down the eye of a storm.
I don't care about that one. I don't care.
I think that would be... Picture that in a helmet, though.
Yeah.
That would be cool in a helmet. Like the Boise State one, where it's just like a giant, like on one side, just a huge...
Oh, yeah. Now I know what you're saying.
You put a little gloss on that thing.
Yeah. That'd be cool.
Yeah. That would be.
But the kids like the matte helmets these days.
Well, if it's they also like anything that's shiny. It's like a bass fish, like TCU's helmets. Those purple ones that like have that mirror finish. Those are cool.
The kids TCU like those does these the days. The combat ones, right?
Mm-hmm. They got the pro combats because they're big time.
Yeah. Any rumblings on alternates for Iowa State this year? Hear anything?
I haven't heard anything. Maybe something.
Well, they usually do like one a year. They'll usually break out something different for one game. But it's always like really bland.
Mm-hmm.
But the Iowa game a couple of years ago, remember those though?
We had the throwbacks.
Yeah, those were sweet.
Those were sweet. I wish we would have done the Jack Trice uniforms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those were badass.
I wish we got to keep those.
What?
But we didn't.
I've hammered Rhodes for years on that.
On what, uniforms?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have honestly no idea why he doesn't change them.
He did. Well, I've asked him before. Like, this was Big 12 Media Days 2 years ago. And I was like, dude, like, I go, I'm going to kill you on this. Like, this is my opinion. I want to get your side so I can, you know, write a balanced article. And he was really cool about it. Like, he totally understands, like, the gap, the way I'm thinking about it compared to him. But he's very much on, like, these are our colors. This is our brand. This is what we do. We don't want to look like Maryland and have people not know who they're watching on television. But the problem is, it's not like Iowa State has this great football brand.
I think, like, hearkening back, and this is, you know, I played at Iowa State, and the tradition that exists at Iowa State is like two decades deep. It's like it started when Sage got there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Marv. Like 1 year in the early 90s. And then the Dirty 30 back in the
Troy sixth, Davis.
Troy Davis, yeah. That was just before Sage was there. Yeah. So, like, that, like, in the 90s with McCarney. And then the Dirty 30. Those are our only bits of tradition. So, outside of, like, you know, what was, when did Iowa State football start? In the early 1900s? From between 1900 to like 1960 something, nothing. Jack Trice.
Yeah.
And then nothing. Then there's the Dirty 30. Then from there until like 1992, another absence of everything.
Until the Marv Seiler game.
Until the Marv Seiler game. And then from there until Troy Davis, there's nothing. So like,
the fact that we can just name off like all the iconic moments.
Over the over 80 years, yeah, there's like three. So yeah, like tradition at Iowa State, not really something you really want to brag about.
Well, and that's why like it's such an interesting dynamic of when you – that I notice on our website and on Twitter and, you know, all the different platforms where I get to talk with fans. It's just so fascinating to me to watch the younger generation. In fact, I'm going to interview Jamie Pollard on Monday. He's going to be on the podcast.
That's a big get.
On Monday, yeah. Because I told Jamie, I don't think that – the younger generation has any sort of a grasp on how big of a deal this new end zone is. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that they understand like how many decades people have been asking for this, mm-hmm, begging for this, dreaming about
this. Because we switched over from Clyde Williams and it was 76.
I believe so. It's in the 70s. Yeah, I don't know.
I think it was 76 is when we switched over from Clyde Williams to Jack Trice.
Yeah, it's just an interesting dynamic, Jeff, because you've got like the old guard portion of the fan base that's probably more realistic. However, they don't challenge. They're not as open-minded as the younger portion of the fan base. And the younger portion of the fan base now with the size of the school is really going to be the dominant portion of the fan base here in a few years, mm-hmm, with as many grads as Iowa State's cranking out these, mm-hmm, days.
And the fact, I think this is something kind of cool to think about, because at what age did you choose sports teams? Like 6 to 8,
yeah,
somewhere in there. And
something
then you hitched on to the Vikings or you hitched on to Iowa State,
yeah,
and you just let it ride. And
yeah,
that's for the rest of your life. We're going to be an Iowa State and a Vikings fan. So kids now, like kids that are born in the Des Moines area and even central Iowa, and say it's even other portions. I think eastern Iowa is pretty locked down, black and gold. But for right now, the dynamics in Des Moines have shifted back to at very least 50-50, maybe, mm-hmm, more Iowa State than Iowa.
A lot of our advertisers believe it's 55-45.
Yep, but Iowa State to Iowa.
Yeah.
Now, thinking about this, with Hoiberg and the exciting Rhodes years that were when I was there until my senior year, so my first 4 years there when we went Insight Bowl, Pinstripe Bowl, just missed a bowl for 1 year, Liberty Bowl, 3 years, 3 bowls in 4 years. Then we kind of stunk it up for my final year. And then last year, say they rebound this year, you have the Rhodes and Hoiberg era where really exciting to watch. And Iowa, not that they're any less successful, because they're probably more successful. They're not probably. They are more successful in football, but it's not as fun to watch. So kids who would watch the cool red team in Ames,
yeah,
they then become Iowa State fans. And I would say the predominant amount are going to be Iowa State fans of kids. So maybe that shift goes from 55-45 to now like 60-40 or 65-35. And
yeah,
predominantly in 10 to 15 years, Iowa or Des Moines is going to be mostly Iowa State fans unless they both basketball and football just tank. It's kind of a cool thought that rising.
Yeah, especially just with the enrollment numbers, too, when you add that on top of it, just the alumni.
And Des Moines is growing, so Iowa State alums aren't going to Chicago or Minneapolis or
And they tend
wherever.
To not. I mean, that, right, like with our Monday evening quarterback show, mm-hmm, or that we're going to do on KXNO and you're going to be a part of this year. Chuck Long's doing it with you, and it's great. Like, Chuck's phenomenal. I'm not downgrading him, but if we wanted to find, like, a younger Iowa player in Des Moines.
Good luck. Can't.
Yeah, it's pretty much impossible.
Mm-hmm.
All right, good stuff. Heartland Flags and Custom Flags, check them out. Check out their website, Twitter at Heartland Flags. And remember, we do this website for free, so when you support our advertisers, you are keeping our website free. We have Jeff Woody in for the podcast today. A little bit of a shorter podcast than we're used to, Jeff, just because we've got Rob Gray and Jared Stansberry, they're going to start doing a weekly podcast together. And
Does Jared fit in the building?
He's a tall kid.
Does he have to like bend over through the door?
He's got a duck. Yeah.
To like kink his head.
So they're coming in to use the equipment when we are done. And we're on a tight schedule today, so we've got to go up to Jack Trice Stadium for the end zone tour. We're giving a media tour at 2 o'clock. So I'll be up there for that. But what I wanted to do, I wanted to just open it up to the fans. today when we had the opportunity to get you in here. And I threw it up on Twitter last night and asked fans to ask you questions about the upcoming Iowa State football season. And the first one comes from a colleague of ours and a former teammate of yours, Zach Spears, which I thought was a good one. I don't think we need to spend too much time on this because I'm not sure how much insight you will actually have, but you're a former captain, right?
Yep.
They only have two captains this year.
Mm-hmm.
Normally four or five. It was earlier in the week where Sam Richardson and Levi Peters were named captains for mm-hmm. the 2015 season. Do you know why they would only pick two?
I don't know why they would only pick two, but I don't think it's that big of a deal.
Yeah, because I don't think it's a big deal either, yeah. But I thought it was a good question by Zach.
In my head, I think if you – one of Rhodes' favorite things to do is – or not favorite things to do. One of his things that he said a lot, I guess, in the preseason and kind of in the offseason is there are three types of people you can have on a team. There are leaders, there are followers, and there are assholes. I can deal with the first two. If you're the third, we got to get you out. So team-wise, as long as – if they're following Sam and Levi, as far as the two completely clear-cut, everybody listens to them. And I can attest to that with Sam. He is the dude. Unquestionably, he is the dude. But if they follow those two, as long as they are following behind them and not trying to divert from them, then that's not a bad problem. I mean, I don't see it as a big deal whether it's two or ten. As long as there is leadership behind them, they may not be captain level leadership. There may not be a guy that's going to, you know, get in a fist fight because somebody was late to a practice, but they may be guys to,
I want that guy.
That's Levi. That's Levi. So you want a guy that's going to get in a fist fight because somebody's late or somebody's talking back. That's Levi Peters. So maybe you got other good leaders that are, you know, not the fist fight guys, but they're going to be the ones that just drive to his house and pick him up. So different kind of guys, maybe not captain-level leadership, but as long as they're leaders or followers and not assholes, they can deal with it.
Reed tweets into us, what is the most important – what's most important for a successful season? Offensive line health, emergence of JUCOs on D, unearthing a running game.
Option one and option three are tied together, and option two is the most important. So not necessarily emergence of JUCOs because there are guys like Gabe Luna, like Trent Taylor, like Dale Pearson, Devlin Cousins, those guys that are coming back. But the most important thing to have a successful season, I guess the biggest question mark, is defensive line. Because the offense is going to be good. As long as the offensive line, doesn't matter what five is there, as long as it's the same five for a while on the offensive line, that offense is going to be good. And I don't have any question about it.
Jeez, you're a hell of a lot more optimistic than I am.
If the offensive line stays healthy and continuous.
Yeah, that's a big if.
If it doesn't, then there's a chance that they're average. But yeah. I think if it's the same five, they have a shot to be very, very good. The defense, on the other hand, was so atrociously bad last year that they have to improve. They have to be adequate this year. And I think the biggest question mark is the defensive line. Like, how good is the defensive line going to be? If they're going to be really good, if they're even going to be average, then we can work with it. If they're going to be bad again, and no one's seen a lot of these guys play, then this defense could be in for another long year because it doesn't matter how good your secondary is. It doesn't matter how good your linebackers are if your defensive line is bad.
I would challenge you on this. And the only reason I say that is I feel like no matter how good the defense gets, like there's always a fairly low ceiling. Right? There's going to be. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, if we're talking a scale of 1 to 10, I feel like the best this defense can be in a best-case scenario is like a 4.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair? Maybe a 5.
And that's what I'm saying. They just got
to
be adequate.
So to me, like, the only way Iowa State goes to a bowl game is if this offense, like, finally takes that step and becomes the offense we saw against Toledo and Texas last year.
And I
consistently.
And I have confidence. The only thing is keeping the offensive, like I said, the only thing is keeping the offensive line healthy. And not even necessarily healthy in the sense of guys aren't going to get, like, minor dings. It's that we can't have anybody miss, like, 8 games in a row.
Yeah.
And if that person misses 8 games in a row, then his backup can't get hurt. So things like they have to have the same 5 and they have to have the same trust in those 5. I think that's going to hopefully that happens, but that's not anything you can control.
I can't believe that Brock Daigle is going to play 12 games this year.
He might not.
I guess my opinion, I think the offensive line is without question, in my mind, the most important unit going into the year.
I think it's – my opinion is the defense. The two most – one and one A.
I think either one of us are wrong. I think we're
– Yeah, but it's in the trenches on either side because the skills around them, we can kind of agree on the fact that the skill positions the widest away from the ball – corner, secondary, wide receiver, quarterback. That's our best.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's our best group. And then
the defensive backs probably the second best position grouping on the team behind wide receiver, right? Mm-hmm.
And then maybe quarterback.
I would put quarterback at three. I'm actually writing this column right now.
Those
I actually rank the defensive line ahead of the offensive line.
I don't know if that's the right pick. That's not because I don't think they are. It's because I have no idea what I'm looking at. With
I
the
guess
defensive
it's
line.
More for me. I've seen the offensive line. And I've never really been that impressed.
Well, you've not seen Wendell Taisse move.
Well, I love him. Like, people know, like, I'm obsessed with that guy. But I want to, like, I need to see it on the field.
Yeah.
I am just so, like, man, I am so cautious with Iowa State offense. Because I feel like every year it's like, okay, here's the step. This is the year. And then it just unravels. And, I'm fatigued by it. I need to see it.
Mm-hmm. No, either way. To answer the Twitter question, most important aspect to generalize it is on either side of the line of scrimmage and in the trenches. And outside of that, I think we're pretty good. But those line positions are paramount to success.
Travis wants to know, if you were a player, do you feel the pressure on Paul Rhodes and his career status? And does this affect you? Like, is it if it does affect you, is this a positive or a negative?
It kind of depends on how much you like him. And, like, if you have a personal connection, like a lot of these guys do, and I did, like, when you were recruited by Rhodes and you were brought in to play under him and you wanted to, you know, stay playing under him, you didn't want to lose that. I mean, if you didn't like him, like, this is not really any secret. When Klonakis was kind of on the chopping block as far as, like, whether he's going to stay or leave.
And all the players were tweeting
players
about
were like,
how they hate him.
Good Lord. Like, God bless America that he's gone. Yeah. Like, nobody liked him. So, but Rhodes is different, where people actually do like him, so they're going to want to try and keep him. So it doesn't really affect you positively or negatively, but you do think about it when you're like, we have to get this done. I mean, if we don't get this done, there's a chance that Rhodes is gone. So I think they do like him, but it really depends on if you do like that coach and you think that's the best option for you personally, then yeah, it's a big deal. You feel a little bit, but if you don't like him, that's not a, I mean, if you don't like him or you're impartial, whatever.
Tony asks an interesting question, and a lot of people were curious about Joel Lanning just because of he's a local kid. Now, I heard over the weekend, and I'm not trying to stew up a quarterback controversy, so don't take it that way, listeners. But I did hear over the weekend that he was unreal during fall camp, like the progress that he has made in a year. So, Tony, with that caveat, Tony wants to know, what role will Joel Lanning play, and are our linebackers up to the task?
Two different questions.
Yeah, way different questions.
Not sure if that's a follow-up to the first one.
Is he insinuating that Joel Lanning needs to play linebacker?
Joel Lanning is not going to play linebacker, nor is he going to play any position other than quarterback, Randy Peterson. But the thing with Joel is that his development is upstairs, so it's all in his head. Physically, the kid has the physical tools to play as the true freshman.
Is the Colin Klein comparison fair to him, like style of play?
No. He's running wise. A more fair comparison to him is Austin Arnott.
Okay.
To where he's a big dude. He's not gonna run by anyone, but he can as a quarterback truck a corner and just flat out make him look stupid. And also different than Colin Klein, Joel has a cannon. I mean, the kid has a steel Jantz arm. Like, can just huck it off his back foot 50 yards type deal. Like, anything that he wants to do with his arm, he can. So his biggest development is upstairs and understanding where to put the ball, what type of velocity to put on it. Because I think I remember from talking to receivers, when he first got there, he would throw like a dig or an in route.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain tempo that you need to put on it where it's got to be fast enough. Like when you're throwing a frisbee, you know, when you throw a frisbee and it's like it's level, it's not wobbly, and it's straight, but it's still like catchable. Yeah. And then there's when you just absolutely just let it rip and fly, and it's going to take someone's tooth out.
Yeah.
Same type of deal with your throw like a dig. You want it to be tight and on a line, but you're not trying to break the guy's fingers. Where Joel would just try and bury it, like as like a Randy Johnson fastball as hard as he could from like 10 yards away. And the receivers are like, dude, what are you doing? I can't catch this.
Yeah.
So understanding what type of pace to put on the ball, understanding what coverages look like, where openings are going to be, reading, things like that. That's where his development is. And it's easy to see. He's a smart kid. So easy to see where his development has taken place or will take place. Now, that being said, to answer the question, his role may be kind of creative package because
like a gadget type guy.
If that is deemed necessary. Now, if Sam and this offense is just clicking, which it has the potential to do, and they're just rolling, there is no earthly reason why you take Sam out of this game. And then in that case, Joel's role is clap and cheer. But if hold the clipboard. If Sam gets hurt, hey, tag me either Grant or
Mark Mangino was quoted last week saying that the backup quarterback competition is still neck and neck.
Mm-hmm. And I think that has more to say about Joel than it does about Grant.
I do too, because if you would have told me that in July, I would have said, no, Grant Rohatch is the backup.
Mm-hmm.
That surprised me. That's one of the bigger surprises to come out of camp, in my opinion.
Yeah, Joel's role really depends on how well Sam does, and not Sam in general, but the offense going. So if it's 3rd and 2 on the 2-yard line, and they have an efficient offense that's getting short yardage conversions done, Joel's not going to play.
All right, here, Coach Woody.
Okay.
You are Paul Rhodes and Mark Mangino. You have executive power right now in this hypothetical.
We change the jerseys first.
Yep.
And then we'll play.
The Under Armour, like, camo jerseys for
Cardinal clones. And gold camo.
Yeah, there we go. Sam Richardson tweaks his ankle, cannot play against Northern Iowa.
His ankle's got to fall off for him to not play.
But well, he can't play.
Okay.
Whatever happens, he can't play.
Okay.
Who do you start at quarterback in the season opener?
Well, I haven't watched him practice. However, I would play Joel for the sense of them not having any idea of what he looks like.
Oh, that's a good answer.
And
it's a good political answer.
Because Grant and Joel are probably very similar, but if you're Grant is more similar to Sam than Joel is playing wise. So Grant, they would have watched his film because he's played before. So they're going to know kind of what he does and what he likes to do and where he's going to go. Where Joel, it's a complete wild card. So it's like, the reason why Oklahoma was so good against Iowa State last year is because Iowa State practiced all of these packages that they'd run before, and they ran like 2 plays out of the package that they showed up with. And then all of a sudden they showed up in that package that Iowa State only practiced like twice, that they'd only run like once or twice throughout the entire season to that point. They did nothing but that stuff. So the same thing with like Joel is they haven't ever seen it. So if Sam were to go down, Joel would be a surprise to you and I, and you can kind of harness his strengths, but I would not really feel strongly about doing that over Grant without seeing practice.
That's fair. I don't think we should waste too much time on the linebackers because we don't really know a lot about Jay Jones
or Reagan
Jordan
Northrup.
Harris. Northrup. I mean, and I'm hearing more and more stuff about this 3-4, so I don't really know what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
To directly answer the question, no, I don't think Iowa State has Big 12 linebackers.
Yet.
Top to bottom. Yeah.
Yet.
These guys could be, but
they're
like,
young.
Have I seen them? No, I can't tell you that they're up for it. I don't know.
That's that sentiment that you have towards the linebackers is the same sentiment that I have towards the defensive line. Like, it's not that I don't think they're going to be good, and it's not that I think they're going to be bad. It's just I have no idea what to expect from them because I've not seen any of them play. I've seen him in person talk to reporters when I was at Media Day. That is the most I've seen of a lot of these JUCO and younger guys. Not seen Reagan Northrup, not seen Jay Jones, not seen Jordan Harris. I've seen Kane, I've seen Levi, but the last time I saw them play a lot in a comfortable position was when I was playing. Because last year, Kane just got thrown in when Jevon got hurt, and then Levi blew his Achilles. So those guys, I haven't seen them at all. So I don't know.
Good question here by Peter. How much does a team's playbook change from week to week? Do you ever run plays that an opponent's D couldn't defend earlier in the season?
Yes. So it changes week to week based on it's going to be what you think. Like what you think of a playbook, what it would do, depending on the coach. So like if you're there and we in fall camp run every single play that you possibly could run during the season, whether it's inside zone or inside runs to outside runs or practice the whole thing, outside runs or outside passes, deep passes, short three steps, five steps, seven steps, everything. You run everything you possibly can in spring ball and fall camp just so you have an introduction to them. Mm-hmm. So then when Coach Mangino or Coach Sturdy is in the meeting room and they go, this corner, this boundary side corner is good, but this field side corner, we can get him all, put, if we isolate Bundridge on him all day, there's no way he can cover Bundridge. So you look at kind of an analysis of where your strengths are to their weaknesses. And if they have, say, in that example, they have a weak field side corner and you know that Bundridge is going to be there. Well, you're going to run trips to the boundary, meaning set three guys into the boundary and set Quentin Bundridge on an island by himself to the field. And then that is one-on-one. If they shade a safety over there, great, whatever. But you're going to beat them one-on-one. And then you understand and you play a chess match and knowing that when we whoop this guy's ass with Bundridge once or twice in a row, they're going to shade the field over here. So once they decide to shade the field when Bundridge wins, we're going to plan for having DeVario and Allen on the other side and Dondre be able to run inside and you've got advantages over there. So you plan for where your strengths are, and that's not including a running game, but that's, you plan on where your strengths are, and then you understand that if you have contingencies on it, like even it, so say it's maybe that guy is better on the field than what he shows on film and Quentin can't beat him. Maybe for whatever reason, Quentin can't beat him. Then you've got to scrap that and understand that there's another thing that you've got to go to. And then there's that other contingency of if he does what we're expecting him to do, they'd be stupid to leave him isolated. So we think they're going to, you know, shade a safety or move a linebacker, flip the front and trade the corners, whatever. We think that they're going to do this thing and we're going to plan this path or this route. So you practice all of those plays throughout the week and make those the sharpest ones. But like, an example of where that completely gets thrown out the window is like my last season.
You're getting old, Jeff.
God, I'm like 40 now.
Yep.
Against Kansas, like we practiced in that zany ice bowl game, senior night, and it was just ice everywhere.
One of my favorite games.
Mine too.
In history.
And because of what we were looking at in that game is that we had more athleticism than Kansas. We were more athletic. We were stronger. We could run outside zones like we wanted. It's what we did the year before, and we beat them with it. So we practiced those outside zones all week, and we didn't really practice that many inside runs because we just didn't need to because we thought we were going to run outside, outside, outside. Well, all of a sudden, you can't run sideways because you can't turn upfield without falling over. So instead of doing that, you completely scrap that game plan, and that is thrown in the trash, and all those things that you practiced all week are gone. So now the plays that you haven't practiced in like a month and a half then come into play because of inside zones and whatever. So you do practice, a long answer to a short question, you practice the ones that you think are going to use in your ideal plan and your contingencies for either one, and then from there, you still have to have everybody know other things because, you know, if for whatever, like the Kansas game or even, not necessarily even the Kansas game, but if it's normal conditions and we call a power play on 3rd and 2 and we get 40 yards off of it, we might want to come back to power even though we haven't practiced it this week. So the playbook changes, but you don't ever forget anything. You just make sure that things you want to run are sharper than the rest.
When I talked with a lot of players in the past and some terminology that's used is like, for instance, with Rhodes, and this goes all the way down to high school, mm-hmm. but like certain plays are in for the week.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, I think of the fake field goals and the yep. fake punts. When do you find out? Is that like on Sunday evening when you guys get together and watch film? I mean, or is that like a Monday thing? Like when you know, like, okay, that we're gonna potentially use a flea flicker if it's open against Iowa, right? Like, at what point is that in during the week?
So, there's kind of three different questions there. One is, regular plays, like regular offensive plays, like for the sake of an easy example, our inside zone play was were 40 and 41. That's a handoff to the or a read option inside or inside handoff to the running back, or the quarterback keeps it, and you've got other options off of that. So inside zone, 40 and 41, we're going to run that all the time. But you have like five different variations off that. There's one where you bring the tight end back, or there's one where you zone with the tight end, and there's one where you have a completely detached tight end. There's one where you motion a wide receiver back. There's all kinds of variations of it. So when you find out when things are going to be in for the game plan for the week, what they like in variations of that is going to be the meetings on Tuesday before practice. So
okay, Tuesday.
Tuesday before practice, because so you play the game on Saturday. Sunday, you come in and you watch the film and you learn from what you did. Mm-hmm. Monday, because the coaches are human. They need to sleep at some point. And Monday, they take that time to analyze, and everybody takes a different section of the opponent, whether it's you watch the third and shorts and you watch second and long and you watch the blitz tape and whatever. And then from there, they come together and Coach Ianni goes, hey, Coach, I like 40Z here. This is one of the ones that I think based on this defensive end, I think we can run pretty well. And Mangino takes all those things into consideration, puts the game plan, a tentative game plan together, starts running them on Tuesday at practice. Well, during the scout period, based on what the look that we're getting, if we have my perception. I'm not a coach, but this is my perception of how it goes. Is say they think that four different variations of 40 might work. We're going to run them in scout team and see how they look on film. And understanding that it's a scout player and not, you know, Adrian Claiborne. Mm-hmm. But if you pretend that that's Adrian Claiborne when you're looking at it on film and you go, there's no way we can get that done, then you cut off two of those based on what it looks like during film. Or during film after Tuesday. So the game plan is really solidified by the time we get there on Wednesday or Thursday based on what practice film has looked like. Now, where the other ones you kind of asked about is special teams, like the fake field goals, the fake punts and stuff like that. Those get put in at various times throughout the week. A lot of times Rhodes likes to do that after practice, or excuse me, before fake field goals before practice on Tuesday, like after, right before you do stretching. So we just kind of walk through it like, you know, you're going to take the snap and you're going to fake an option and pitch it to the kicker and Cole's going to throw it back to Jeff. Mm-hmm. Jeff's going to throw it, whatever. All those kinds of funky things he likes to put in before practice and just in a walkthrough. And then we'll practice them on Thursday.
Okay.
The trick plays, with Herman and Messingham both, every Thursday we had just a non-contact, no pad practice where you're still running everything full speed, but it's on air. And if you're running against a scout team, it's literally just let them block you. Like, you're not trying to disrupt anything as a scout player.
Gotcha.
And we practiced every possible trick play that we've ever had in the book for two periods. For 10 minutes, you practice every trick play you possibly had against like a half-assed scout team. Mm-hmm. And just so you know what it's going to kind of feel like, and if we do decide to call it, then you know what a double reverse pass is going to be like because we've run it at least once before. So those,
for instance, though, like the fake PAT that mm-hmm. was not successful against Nebraska in 2010.
Right, which it should have been if there was just a little more zip in the ball.
Yeah, I mean, it was there. Mm-hmm. Was that play practiced throughout the week?
Yep, that was ran. He always put it in. Sometimes he'll do it like if he's not 100% sure, like if he's done it, if he knows that it's going to work, we'll just walk through it on air. If he's still kind of deciding whether or not it's going to work, he'll like secretly in stretch period come say like, because we had gotten a sheet before during meetings that says this is what it is and this is what you're going to be doing during the trick play. And then Rhodes, because every time we open up practice, it's stretch and then right away you go and we'll kick like four PATs or four field goals from like extra point distance from 10, from 20, and from 30 yards, and just so full speed against the defense with pads so you can practice it every day. So in what Rhodes would sometimes do is like sneak up to him and be like, hey, second kick from the left hash, we're running this fake field goal. So we know, but the defense doesn't. So we can get a genuine surprise look. So like when they're not expecting a trick play, if it can be quickly recovered against, mm-hmm. then we're going to scrap it and maybe not even have a trick field goal for the week. Or if it really works, then that gives him more confidence to be like, hey, if we get, because he said this before, you know, if it's the end of the half and it's a close game and we have the ball in either one of the hashes inside the 20, we are going to run this. So something like that where he knows when he's going to do it, but he's got to get a real good confidence with it. Because where he always has these plays, The only time they don't work is when we don't execute them. Schematically, they're always going to work. So he's never going to call a trick play that he's not sure it's going to work.
Well, and I guess, too, and maybe I was unfair earlier in the summer, because the longer I thought about it, the more I feel like maybe I was. But there is this thought out there that Rhodes has gotten less aggressive over the years. But I also, you know, like on a 4th-and-1, a 4th-and-2, you're at midfield, the crowd wants you to go for it. But you got to think about, too, I mean, the offensive line, how poor were they on 3rd-and-short last year? Mm-hmm. You know, there's not a lot of incentive for a coach to go for it mm-hmm. in that situation when your line is literally getting no push at all.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think he's been less aggressive? What's your take on
it? Well, he's less confident.
Yeah.
He's less aggressive because Rhodes never takes chances. And I mean that in the sense that he's going to run some crazy stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, fake punts, whatever, like the one to Kwon Floyd last year.
Yeah.
Hit him right in the face. That's not a chance. The fact that he ran that, he knew exactly 100% that it was going to work. Well,
like
if he doesn't
fake PAT.
Fake PAT against Nebraska, if Daniel Keel throws that ball 2 feet farther or puts a little bit more spiral on it instead of a duck, Colin Franklin is standing wide ass open in the back of the end zone. It's not a chance.
4 bowl games in 4 years.
Right. And so he doesn't take chances. And if he's not 100% sure, he's not going to run it. If the team does not give him confidence that they can get that done, whether it's a 4th down, whether it's a 3rd and short, you know, or a 3rd and 18 and they get 2 yards and it's 4th and 16, we, like against Kansas State, I remember when we're down playing in my junior year in Manhattan, Kirby ran a fake punt that he had to put his shoulder down to get 8 yards to get a 1st down. But it wasn't a chance because he knew he could do it.
Yeah.
So the reason why he may seem less aggressive is because he was less confident in the teams that we had, whether that was my senior year or the year after, that it's not a guaranteed shot for it to get done. It's unconventional, but not a chance. And that's, I think he may be less aggressive because he's less confident.
That's good analysis right there. Let's move on to a question here from Jeff, and then I want to add to this question because I think it could spark some good analysis from you. Will Sam Richardson be able to throw a deep ball consistently enough to take advantage of our big receivers? And what I'd like to add to that is the matchup problems that Allen Lazard, Quentin Bundridge, and DeVario Montgomery
and Dondre Daly.
And I've heard he's been awesome mm-hmm. during camp as well. So there's going to be matchup problems somewhere. A defense can't double all those guys,
nope.
right? So who do you – put yourself in an opposing defensive coordinator's spot. Like, I mean, who do you leave open? You know what I mean? Like, I'm who do you think benefits the most of these receivers? Is it Dondre? Because I'm just trying to think. I've been asked so many times, who leads the team in receptions? Who leads the team in touchdowns? And it's really hard to analyze that.
So they're different. They're all pretty – not all pretty different. They're – different guys. So Bundridge is a burner. He's not a guy that's really going to moss anybody. Moss meaning, for those of you that don't understand what that means, what Randy Moss would do to somebody is just jump over top of them, and they may feel like they have a position, but he just reaches over top and plucks the ball and then walks into the end zone.
Yeah.
So Bundridge isn't a guy that's going to moss anybody. He's going to be the one that's going to catch it and just outrun everyone like he did against Texas, where Lazard and DeVario and Devo Montgomery, what those guys are – what their MO is they can just moss dudes. So where do you leave them open? If you've got 4 really capable wide receivers and you know that any one of them is going to be a threat, you have 2 choices. 1, you pull everybody back in coverage and attempt to cover all of them. Or 2, you get to the quarterback before they get open. So if I'm a defensive coordinator and I know that the worst down and distance for a defensive coordinator is like 2nd and 2. Because they can take a shot, and if they, you know, throw it 70 yards down the field, if it lands incomplete, then you still have 3rd and 2. So, like, the worst down and distance for a defense is 2nd and short. And so say it's 2nd and 2. It's like a 3-1 count in baseball. If it's 2nd and 2, and I know that they've got 4 wide, 2x2, and my guys can't cover them. You know, mm-hmm. if it's Texas or Baylor or something like that, they got confidence they're going to play 1-on-1. But instead of letting my guys be on an island with a 3-man pass rush and trying to drop everybody back, I'm going to blitz the hell out of this offensive line and see if they can pick them up before those guys get open.
See, that's probably how Iowa State gets attacked.
Probably. And that's kind of been the MO for Iowa State in the past, because the offensive line has been so decimated by injuries that the biggest thing, you know, like I've talked about before, the biggest thing with the offensive line is continuity and knowing that when I go, say they've got a twist with the defensive end and the, or defensive end and the tackle on either pair of those that are going to twist, and then they're going to run a linebacker around the outside of that. So there's five guys that are coming, but all of them are coming from a different spot. If I've played with the same guy next to me, I know that if there's going to be a twist, he's going to tell me, you know, he'll say twist, whatever, and he's going to make the right calls. And he's got, you know, Brock Daigle's got longer arms than his backup, so Daigle can hold on to it a little bit longer, so I can pass off my guy a little bit longer, and then we can just coordinate it all together.
Mm-hmm.
So if the offensive line could pick it up, it's not a big deal. But if I'm a defensive coordinator, I'm going to send as many twists, stunts, blitzes, stuff to get to Sam and move him off his spot so that he just has to huck it up there instead of getting an on-time, on-drop route. Because if he gets on-time, on-comfort shots to any one of those wide receivers, he can pick the best matchup and just go. But if not, you got to hit him before he throws.
All right, we got about 5 minutes to go, so that's good analysis. Let's kind of do a little rapid fire here.
Okay.
Which college football fan base is the most delusional? I'd say Nebraska.
Nebraska or Notre Dame?
Notre Dame. That's interesting. I think Iowa could be considered. If everything clicks with this team, what is the ceiling? 8 wins? 9? Just curious.
There's only three that I see that if they play as good as they can play, there's really only three that I don't think are like really super achievable. Baylor, TCU, and Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Those are the only three that I don't think they can win. Oklahoma State's at home. Texas, it's in a home. Kansas State, it's always close. West Virginia, always close. Iowa, Toledo, Texas Tech, Kansas, Northern Iowa. All of those are winnable games. So I think there's only three that I don't see them winning. So everything possible goes right, 9-3.
Tony wants to know, who are sleeper players on offense, defense, and special teams who could make an impact this year? I think we already identified Dondre Daly.
Yep, Dondre on the offense. And then I still think Mike Warren. I mean, I love the way that kid plays. Mike and Dondre are the two that I'd pick on offense. Defensively, it'd be one of those guys like a Jay Jones or like a Reagan Northrup that haven't really played before and mm-hmm. aren't getting a ton of recognition. Like people are talking about, you know, Demond Tucker and Jordan Harris and stuff like that. But I think Jay Jones and Reagan Northrup would be the two on defense that I think kind of be sleeper dominant players. Not dominant, but sleeper really high quality players.
I think a guy who hasn't gotten enough publicity is Kawan Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
He was pretty good at the end of last year, and he's going to be in an enhanced role this year in that strong safety spot.
And he doesn't have Kamari.
Yeah, he doesn't have a lot to worry about because Kamari's next to him.
Right. If Kamari can stay healthy, and then you got Kamari at safety, and you got Nigel and Sam, and then you got Jamal Wiltz is going to come in as probably your nickel or dime guy. You got a lot of stuff around you, so you can take a couple more chances.
I think that's it. There's some other stuff in there, but I think we covered the majority.
The only one that I saw, which was like a funny story, and I couldn't think of any, but I did think of one story that I haven't told before, and I'm going to take credit for Tom Herman being as good as he is. I'm kidding. But one of the times we were talking about those trick plays, and I just remember a story, like I remember an incident, and this is when we were down in Oklahoma, and this was when A-Rob was still there. So that would have been 2010.
Oh, I hated that game.
That was when got
52-0.
Just whooped.
So it's worst night of Cyclone reaction ever.
So when we're in that game, and we got at half field. It's the only time, or at midfield. It's the closest that we got to the end zone, and we called a trick play, and it was supposed to be. It was our trick plays, like the double reverses and our stuff like that, were called cash, money, and bank.
Yeah.
And cash is a reverse pass. So the quarterback, Austin, would hand to A-Rob, and A-Rob would hand it to Williams, or Darius Starks, because he played quarterback in high school, and then Darius Starks would throw it to Jake Williams. Well, we called that play, but we had never run it, or we had never run it out of two backs, and I was in there, and A-Rob and I didn't know what to do. Like, we were asking, like, what are we going? What's going on? What do we do? And, well, it's like, we didn't have time to call timeout, didn't anything like that. So we end up just running the play, and we ran it in the wrong direction. And A-Rob and I were doing the same thing. It was the wrong thing, but it was the same thing. Well, and then we get to film the next day, and Jake Williams is wide open. I mean, 40 yards, nothing by him. And Herman is just losing. Herman and Coach Pope, the coordinator and running backs coach, are just losing their minds. Like, how could you miss on that? That's terrible. I'm like, you know, it's one of those, I don't know what I did wrong because I don't know what I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
And then Herman's like, we've run that play twice. And I'm like, no, we haven't. What are you talking? No, we haven't. This is one of the reasons why I don't think Herman is pretty. He's neutral to me. He doesn't like me or doesn't dislike me, but this is one of the reasons why I went from like to neutral. And I went in the I went and filmed the next day.
You're a smartass.
I was a smartass. Uh-huh. And I went to film the next to his office the next day, and I was like, "Hey, Coach Herm, and I'm not trying to say this to defend ourselves, but we've never run that play before. And I don't I get it, but I don't want A-Rob to get that like black eye. We've never run it." He's like, "Yes, we have." And he goes, "Play what or play X and play Z in this period of practice on this day." And I'm like, really? I don't remember doing that. We go back, and it was in that specials period that we did. Well, Herman was talking to a quarterback, and the plays were just kind of going on behind him. We played with 10 men on the field on that specific play.
Oh.
So we practiced it with one running back out there, and it was just either just me or just A-Rob, and we'd practice it with one, and Herman goes, "That's my fault. It's never going to happen again." From that point on, Herman never made another mistake, ever. So I'm going to take credit for Ohio State's national championship.
Wow.
So you're welcome, Buckeye fans.
You're also solely responsible for the college football playoff.
I don't think solely responsible is the proper term.
Well, your team is.
Well, we're kind of, sort of.
You guys forced the all-SEC-BCS championship game that thwarted us into the playoff era.
Was it 9-6? No, that was the regular season.
That was the regular season game. The playoff
one. It was like 21-7 or something like that.
I actually thought the 9-6 was more entertaining. Much more. I thought, I'm fine with that. As long as it's like two badass defenses. Like, I'm totally.
It's two terrible offenses, 9-6 is.
Well, like, that game was two badass defenses just kicking the crap out of the. Like, I'm fine with that. I don't want to watch it all the time.
It's not Wake Forest and Virginia Tech last year.
Exactly.
0-0.
That's my point.
Regulation.
Like, that is a different breed of defense that we were watching that night. I'll never forget watching that game. Like, we had a. You've been in my cave. It's a nice little cave
it's
to watch a game
cave.
In.
It's got a projector. It's a 27-inch TV.
27-inch.
It's a joke, Chris.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say don't come down on a man's TV.
I'm not trying to insult your manhood. It's a joke.
No, but I was thoroughly entertained by that 9-6 game. I don't want to watch it every week.
I'll take
but give me every once in a while. I'm fine with it.
I'm an offense player, so I like to see points. So I'll take West Virginia, Virginia Baylor, 70-63, any day. I remember watching that game in the hotel
because
we were.
It was West Virginia's first game in the Big 12, right?
Yeah, and it was. Geno was the quarterback, and then Florence was the quarterback for Baylor.
Yeah.
And it was just up and down. And I remember watching that game, and it was like 42-30 at the end of halftime. And I'm like, what the hell is going on?
That was insane.
We watched on film. That was partially the offenses being really good.
Those defenses were bad.
Those defenses.
You guys beat
just
Baylor
atrocious.
That year.
Yeah, we did. That was when
Steele had the 5 touchdown pass.
And that was Knott's last game. Because he had his shoulder dislocated, and he played with a shoulder dislocation and had surgery the following Monday.
Good stuff.
Forced fumble in the first possession and recovered it.
God, he was
a superhero.
We need to get him to come down here and podcast with us.
Yeah, I'm down with that. He's in Central Iowa now.
Yeah, he emailed me the other day. We need to all get together.
I'm down, down with that. Then I don't have to talk about defense as much.
No, that'd be fun.
Because he's way smarter about that.
We should just
get
him in.
Let's get on that.
Yeah, we need to get on that. Heartland Flags and Custom Flags bringing us today's podcast. Thanks to them for their new sponsorship of CycloneFanatic.com. HeartlandFlags.com. You can go into their newly expanded store as well at 3719 Southwest 9th Street in Des Moines. Check out their ad at CycloneFanatic.com.
Go buy a flag. It's Flagville.
It's Flagville here at CF. He's Jeff Woody. I'm Chris Williams. Thanks for listening, everybody.